The Day in News happens here.
We have a teacher shortage in Ontario.
Every day, as events unfold, we're here for you.
And they are projecting increases in spending.
This is The Daily Review on Newstalk 580 CFRA. Or stream us anytime on the iHeartRadio app.
Here is an encore segment from The Morning Rush with Bill Carroll.
I probably see at least a couple patients a day, and definitely in our after-hours clinic, patients that come in that say to me, I know I'm okay, but I just need a note for my employer.
I know I'm okay, but I need a note from my employer. Well, if you're okay, why were you off? Oh, you got better now, and it's retroactive. Dr. Dworkin was complaining about that yesterday. How can he know what you had last week if you're healthy now? So, and he's being expected to write a note saying, yes, I psychically know they had a common cold. So most doctors seem to be very happy with this idea of scrapping the doctor's note. But aren't you annoyed by that person at your office? Unless you are that person. Maybe you are. Maybe you're that person who's sick all the time, and we could all predict it. And we know that they're not sick. They're just, or they have a minor little thing, and you would show up to work. Some people show up to work with a bullet wound. Others, one sniffle, one sneeze, one wayward sneeze. That's it. Especially if it was the night after Super Bowl Sunday or a Jays home opener somewhere and you want to drive to Toronto. So that's what concerns me, is how do companies keep track of that? Because in the end, it's not just about the company's productivity. It's about their colleagues. It's about you and me who have to pick up the slack when people take time off. Well, in my case, the way the show's structured, I'm either here or not here. And if I'm not, if somebody else takes time off, then it's my team that has to pick up the slack. So it's just about your boss. Alex Lucifero is a partner at Samfira Tamarkin LLP, and they deal with labor issues all the time. On the line now, good morning.
Good Friday morning, Bill.
How effective are doctor's notes anyway at protecting companies from the chronically faking sickness employee? Are they useful?
Well, listen, when it comes to medical leaves and medical notes, we're talking about such a broad spectrum here of circumstances and situations, Bill, that it's tough to answer that question with any one given scenario. When it comes to this particular change to the legislation, and I think you're right, I agree with you, Bill, the feedback from this news has been generally positive, certainly positive from the medical profession and community, and it's been positive for employees as well. But listen, it's really important to keep in mind, Bill, what we are talking about here. The change to the legislation only relates to a job-protected leave under the Employment Standards Act. And that job-protected leave under the Employment Standards Act, when it comes to sick days, is only 3 days per year. Bill, that's what we're talking about here. So what the government is going to be doing is introducing an amendment to the legislation to ensure that if you are using one of those 3 sick days per year in the province of Ontario, your employer will not have the right to ask for a medical note. If we're talking about a leave that's potentially longer than that, or if you've already taken those 3 days for the year and you're beyond those 3 days and off sick and or calling in sick from work, your employer will have the right to ask for a medical note. So again, we're talking about a very small slice of the pie here in the general context.
No, but it does happen. I've worked with colleagues who were sick on average once a week. It was as predictable as, well, more predictable than the weather. You just knew. And no one is sick that often. So, and it's a different thing every time. It's not like, you know, cancer treatments or something. So, I mean, you do need a mechanism. And I think the doctor's note was mostly about making the employees worry. If I cheat and they ask me for a note, that could be problematic for me. So you're hoping it keeps people honest, and it probably keeps some honest. The government clearly, though, is concerned about it a bit as well, because they said, look, your employer can ask you for an attestation, which I guess is like a sworn statement that you were legitimately sick. Is that the right way to interpret that?
Yeah, that's correct. And alternatively, they can ask for some other documentation, like, for example, a prescription receipt. So, and
prescription would still require a trip to the doctor in most cases too, though,
or the pharmacy even. But you know, that's tricky in and of itself, because, you know, quite interestingly, an employer doesn't really have the right to know what kind of medical issue the employee is dealing with. They don't need or again, have the right to know what the diagnosis is or what particular treatment plan you're undergoing if you're ill. And of course, a pharmacy prescription might tip their hand in that respect.
Sure.
So that's an interesting one right there. But again, you know, the point I wanted to make is, listen, I think, you know, and keep in mind, these amendments were introduced by our health minister, not even necessarily the Ministry of Labor directly. So certainly the main goal here was to alleviate some of that administrative burden from our doctors in the province, right? It's obviously going to have effect on employees and employers for, again, those 3 days per year of unpaid sick leave. I don't know if it's going to have the dramatic effect that, you know, that the government is suggesting. It might, again, if you're dealing with a longer-term leave, or as you said, if you have that one employee taking a sick day, you know, every week or every second week, well, listen, that employee is going to run out of those three unpaid sick days that are job-protected, you know, very, very quickly. And as an employer, I guess you'll have some solace that, well, you can ask for a medical note in those kinds of situations.
Right. So you feel there's enough protection for both the employer and the employee here that this doesn't really change the game legally very much?
Yeah, listen, I actually think in the grand scheme of things, it's a positive move, because again, if we're dealing with one sick day here or there, and again, in the grand scheme of things, a maximum of three per year, right? Listen, number one, I think most employers, Bill, do not ask an employee for a sick note or a doctor's note if they're taking 1 to 3 sick days per year. In the grand scheme of things, it's not a lot of time off. You know, that's not an employee that's calling in sick.
Yeah, your employer's
on
a jerk
basis.
In that case, I would say.
Yeah, and those employers are few and far between, you know, for good. And so, you know, in that respect, yeah, listen, it's a step in the right direction. It's a very small step in the right direction. I don't think it's going to move the needle in any particular way.
Okay. I can still be annoyed, though, by people who burden their colleagues by taking time off when you know they shouldn't.
As we should be, especially when it's not true, when it's taking advantage of the employer and of your colleagues, as you rightfully said.
Hangover is not an illness.
Fair enough.
Thank you, Alex. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Bill. Always a pleasure.
Alex Lucifero, partner at Samfiro Tumarkin LLP.
We'll return with more of the big stories trending now on The Daily Review.
On News Talk 580 CFRA. Live, local, breaking news, weather and traffic. The day in news happens here. Now back to The Daily Review on News Talk 580 CFRA. Or stream us anytime on the iHeartRadio app.
Here is an encore segment from Ottawa at Work with Patricia Ball.
A lot of people going through some really tough stuff in their lives. And it was certainly underlined as you're listening to some of the family members of Nick Chenier yesterday, young man who, having kids almost the same age, this one really, really hit me certainly, but died last year while working. He was trimming hedges and his instrument made contact with a live wire within the hedge that he was trimming. And we are seeing the results of that yesterday, as there was a charge of criminal negligence causing death that was laid against the supervisor in this case. And I think when we heard about that charge, a lot of us kind of looked at each other in the newsroom and said, wow, that's a pretty serious charge. And that's not something that we can recall seeing very often in cases that are similar to these. Sean McKenney is the president of the Ottawa and District Labor Council. He is looking at cases like this all the time and knows much better than we do just how rare this is. Sean joins us on the line now. Good morning to you, Sean. Hi, Sean. Are you able to hear me?
I am.
Hi. Thanks for being here. So you also made a comment yesterday that this was very rare, that this does not happen very often.
It was in 2004 when our parliament changed the criminal code to allow for these kinds of charges in respect to workplace fatalities or injuries. Prior to that, it was just the individual provincial ministries of labor. And in Ontario, it would have been the Ontario Ministry of Labor that would have filed charges. So since 2004, when the code was changed, those charges could be laid by the police and by the Crown Attorney. But you're right in that this is the first time in our area that, in fact, it has happened. And there's been a lot of work by a lot of people to have the Crown Attorney and the various police departments within communities focus their energies and efforts towards these kinds of charges. And as you know, and understandably to a point, is that, again, because the Ministry of Labor was tasked with doing this, and pretty much solely the Ministry of Labor, now that the police and Crown Attorney can do it under the criminal code, there seems to be at times just a little bit of hesitancy to do that. So yesterday, yes, that was a good news story in respect to for workers in this community and elsewhere as well. And it sends a signal, as far as we see it, to employers that they need to be incredibly cautious going forward, because this kind of charge could be leveled against them.
And a criminal charge being laid is a long way from a conviction, and everyone has a right to fair process. And so I want to be careful in talking about this with you. But in laying the charge, the allegation is that more could have been done to make sure that this was a safe environment, that more could have been checked at the scene to make sure that there were proper precautions taken, that it was a safe environment for this particular worker. And I think that's what, obviously, what you're working for on a regular basis, what families want to know. I had my son heading off to a very different job yesterday. He was going to help take down a dome at a recreational facility. And I thought, wow, that's different. And I wonder how that works. And I guess there's someone there that knows what that process is. And that's, you want to have faith that there is always someone there who is on scene, who is supervising or is at the helm of a company, who knows how to make that situation safe, who knows what the proper precautions are to be taken. And this this charge being laid is an allegation that there was more that could have been done to make sure that this scene was safe.
Yeah, you know, you're 100% correct. And it's not just you want people to have a legal responsibility to know. And, you know, on that note, so many different, in this particular case, so many lives are impacted and affected. For sure, it's Jennifer Chenier, so Nick's mother, and it's Nick's brother, Michael. But the individual that was charged as well, you know, my understanding is he has a family. He did not show up to work that day thinking that he was going to cause or help to cause the death of Nick Chenier. For sure, this has impacted him. And that's one of the frustrations that we continually go with. It was so unnecessary. If the proper procedures would have been put in place, and this wouldn't have happened. And I'm convinced of that. But again, I want to be very clear. It's not just the family. For sure, you know, we acknowledge the pain and the sorrow that they're going through. But so many people elsewhere impacted, the coworkers as well, that would have known Nick, that may have been working with him the day before. They're all impacted and affected for the rest of their lives. Again, it's a frustration that we feel continuously. And we firmly and fundamentally believe that if the police would lay more charges such as this, then employers would get the message, and that proper health and safety will be provided for workers at all workplaces.
So we are pretty much out of time here, but let me just ask you quickly. I have someone texting in saying, I feel like people have a fictional sense of safety when at work. There's only so much a manager or supervisor can do, talking about work smart and whatnot. Is there something overall that can be put in place in some way that prevents some kind of a tragedy like this from happening again? What is the biggest change that could happen right now that you would like to see that might prevent this kind of thing in future?
You know, what I can say is the proper enforcement of the Occupational Health and Safety Act. And in that act, it's the training for everybody on that project. So it is the workers, of course, but it's also the supervisor. It's also the constructor of the project, managers of the project that have a duty and a responsibility to ensure the safety of all individuals. Again, as I always say, and that's that we go to work because we have to. We have to put food on the table, no different than your son. The intention is to come home at the end of the night. The intention as parents would be to come home at the end of the night on a weekend, on a Friday night, and hang with their kids on the weekend, not to not come home and have our children affected in an incredible negative way.
Sean, are you involved with a day of mourning ceremony that someone has texted about Sunday? It's at Vincent Massey Park?
Yep, we're set up there, and everybody is invited. It's at 12:30 Vincent Massey Park. It's there. One of the reasons it's there is because of its proximity to the now Heron Road Workers Memorial Bridge. the collapse in 1966, August 10th, 1966. And Nick's mother, Jennifer Chenier, will be one of our speakers at the event on Sunday, April 20th at Vincent Massey Park.
Sharing her emotion and some of what she has been through, I'm sure it will be a very powerful event. Sean, thank you very much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Very welcome.
We'll return with more of the big stories trending now on The Daily Review.
On News Talk 580 CFRA. Live, local, breaking news, weather and traffic. The day in news happens here. Now back to The Daily Review on News Talk 580 CFRA. Or stream us anytime on the iHeartRadio app.
Here is an encore segment from The Vashi Capello Show.
My next guest is a familiar name to many of you listening. She served as our country's health minister for a number of years under this government. And Dr. Jane Philpott has a new book entitled Health for All, A Doctor's Prescription for a Healthier Canada. Hi, Dr. Philpott. Good to talk to you. Great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
I remember reading this book in advance and thinking, oh, this is going to be very relevant to conversations Canadians are having, particularly around primary care. I mean, to put it bluntly, so many people, I think we all know, do not have access to a family doctor. How big of an issue do you think that is now versus when you were serving as health minister?
Well, it's a huge issue now, and it has definitely gotten worse over the last decade. So we now know that there are at least 6.5, probably going on 7 million Canadians who don't have a family doctor or any other access to primary care. That's 22% of our population. And those people don't have a place to go when they need someone to take care of their diabetes or look after their children as they're growing up or try to help make sure that they don't get cancer. So it's a huge problem in our health system, and it has a ripple effect on all the rest.
And this week we heard from a number of people representing medical schools saying that the part of the trickle-down effect is that there's now a decline in interest to be trained as a family doctor in those schools. I know that you're very well acquainted with one medical school in particular, but more broadly others. What do you think that's emblematic of?
Well, you're right. That is a big part of the problem, is that fewer and fewer of our medical students, including those of ours at Queen's University, are choosing family medicine. It speaks to the fact that we haven't built a system for primary care that is attractive, that addresses the conditions of work that family doctors find themselves in. And so, you know, essentially we've got a non-system rather than saying every Canadian should have access to a primary care home, just like every child has access to a public school. Those should be publicly funded. They should include a whole team, not just family doctors, but nurse practitioners, nurses, social workers, dietitians. And we could actually build a system so there was a place for everyone in their neighborhood where they could access the front door of the healthcare system.
Do you think it's necessary for that system to actually come to fruition, that the starting point is what you mentioned, that legal right is essentially assigned to Canadians, that it's not just a nice to have, but a must have?
Yes. Well, you know, people have been talking about the fact that we need to have 100% access to primary care for a very long time. So this is not a new idea. But given my experience in government, as I've reflected on, you know, what has been the impasse? Why have we not been able to see this happen? And then I've reflected on the fact that, you know, countries that do have 100% access to primary care, they have laws, federal laws that say it's a right. And they invest in primary care, which is a good return on investment because it means you're paying for conditions up front rather than once they get worse. And so it's my hypothesis that I write about in the book that if we actually put this in law, in a federal law, to say that every Canadian has a right to primary care, support provinces to be able to deliver on that, that we could actually build the system that has never existed in this country.
Was that ever an idea bandied about when you were in cabinet? And I'll preface the question also by, or add sort of from context to the question by saying, look, I think our listeners are clear that healthcare is provincial jurisdiction, that the provinces play a massive role, but that there clearly is an increasing role for the federal government vis-a-vis transfers, the expansion of those transfers, in any strings that are possibly attached, which kind of started in some ways in some of the deals that you made with provinces.
Yes, exactly. So I strongly believe that there's a role for the federal government. I actually think all orders of government need to work together on this. And that's what we've seen historically in this country when we have made big changes to our health and social infrastructure. I mean, when hospital insurance and doctor's insurance came in the very first place, it was started in Saskatchewan, but then it was picked up by the rest of the country. So there, certainly it would be wonderful if one or two or more provinces decided they are going to build a system where everyone has a primary care home. But as we're waiting for them to do that, the federal government could take leadership on this, could say that we believe this is essential, gather the health ministers and premiers together from across the country and do something that really matters to all Canadians.
So do you envision that as the introduction of that kind of legislation?
That would be, you know, obviously it needs to start with working together, collaborating, conversations. Provinces don't like things sprung upon them, of course. But, you know, I certainly saw while I was in government that if you work together well with provinces, we did it on medical assistance in dying, we did it on cannabis, we sat down with provinces, mapped out what we were going to do. We did the same on child welfare for Indigenous families. So I have lots of evidence of how well it works when the federal government and the provinces collaborate together on issues that matter to Canadians, and there's nothing that matters more than having access to primary care.
When you were studying those other jurisdictions that are able to provide primary care to a larger swath of their population, beyond the legislation and sort of the idea that you have a legal right to access primary care, what else stood out to you as things that do work in those jurisdictions?
Well, it's a great question. And in fact, you know, what you see in many of those jurisdictions is that they fund very well some of the issues that support health writ large. So often these are countries that do better than we on making sure that housing is well supported. And some of them have a universal basic income so that they don't have such high rates of poverty. So certainly European countries that have got those strong social structures tend to get much better health outcomes at lower cost, and it's partly because of their primary care system, but it's also partly because they've invested in those social determinants of health. But those are all things that we can do better on here in this country, and it's not that we're going to end up spending more, but we're going to actually support people in the areas that they need for wellness.
You mentioned also sort of the conceptualization of what that access to primary care would look like, that it doesn't necessarily always have to be just a family doctor, that it could be a team of people. And we've heard that kind of, I would say, bandied about in different provinces. But I don't know if from my own experience in the healthcare system, I don't know if that's necessarily, you know, being realized, not nearly to the degree where it would be more effective in a broad way. What do those kinds of groupings look like to you, and how difficult do you anticipate it is to implement them?
Well, it's not difficult to implement if there's political support for it. So in Ontario, we've got some great examples of that. About 20 years ago, the province made available this concept of family health teams. And there's actually about a quarter of the people of Ontario that are served by a family health team. They have fantastic opportunities available to them because they do have not only a family doctor, but a team that usually includes nurse practitioners. Often they'll be physiotherapists, they'll be dietitians or social workers or pharmacists on the team. It means that you actually get support for things that are not normally publicly funded, and you can make sure that the right provider is providing the care. Family doctors are expensive. They, you know, there are some things that only doctors can do, but there are a lot of things that doctors often do which could be done just as well or even better by someone else on the team. So we need to share the work. And patients love being part of family health teams. And in fact, they've told us in a number of studies, including the Our Care study, which was recently completed, that what they want is a team-based model of care.
Just before we go, Dr. Philpott, I have to ask you about the capital gains tax changes, because doctors specifically have come out through the CMA saying that they feel like it's going to negatively impact them. Do you think that was the right or wrong move by the federal government?
Well, I wouldn't be inclined to weigh in on tax policy. That's not my area of expertise. But I think what I can say is that this is a really tough time for family doctors. They are demoralized in many ways. They've been through some really rough years. And lots of them are leaving the profession. So it strikes me as a particularly difficult time to introduce something like this, because it feels really worrisome for many physicians, and we're working hard to try to retain those doctors.
Okay, I'm going to leave it on that note. Dr. Philpott, congratulations on your new book. It's an excellent read. I hope all our listeners will go out and grab a copy for themselves. Thanks for making the time for our conversation.
Thanks so much for having me.
Dr. Jane Philpott, former Minister of Health, of course, also the author of the new book, Health for All, A Doctor's Prescription for a Healthier Canada.
We'll return with more of the big stories trending now on The Daily Review.
On News Talk 580 CFRA. Live, local, breaking news, weather and traffic. The day in news happens here. Now back to The Daily Review on News Talk 580 CFRA. Or stream us anytime on the iHeartRadio app.
Here is an encore segment from Ottawa Now with Christy Cameron.
Unsurprisingly, when you ask the question, what's holding you back from getting into an electric vehicle? The big points that come up right away. Range anxiety, people concerned that they won't be able to make it to their destination. People concerned about cost. I think given the affordability crisis, that's a big one. That's a huge one right now. People are stretched thin, budgets are tight. So you look at the upfront investment that you'd have to put into getting an electric vehicle. And even though they are becoming more affordable over the years, they have a higher upfront cost. And as a result, people are turned off of them, or they're worried about getting into the market, or they've got concerns about size. Premier Doug Ford and the Prime Minister were both part of a joint EV announcement yesterday, Honda pouring $15 billion into building four new manufacturing plants in the province.
This is historic. It's the largest auto investment in Canadian history. It's a tremendous win for Ontario, for our workers, for all of Canada.
So he's painting it as a win, and the Prime Minister is painting it as a way forward to hit their targets, because the federal government wants all new vehicles to be zero emissions by 2035. We'll play this clip now of the Prime Minister, who said that this announcement is one step closer to that.
Today is a great day for workers, for Honda, for Ontario, and it's a great day for Canada.
One of the primary considerations, as I alluded to, I think is cost. Another might be space. For some reason, it seems like the public is hesitant to make the switch. And you can look at a bunch of different public opinion surveys. For example, there's a recent national survey by Auto Trader that found EV interest in cars. And it's actually gone down, not just in the last couple of years, but in the last year in particular, it went down again. And by the way, Auto Trader is Canada's largest auto marketplace. Meantime, you look at Tesla, like I noted in my opening today, and it has been struggling to maintain its momentum. Sales have dropped this year, and so have share prices. Here to talk a little bit more about all of this, Josefa Petrunic, who is the CEO of the Canadian Urban Transit Research and Innovation Consortium. Hello, thank you so much for coming on the program.
Hi there, thanks for having me.
When you talk to people about electric vehicles and you see public opinion polls like the one that I just cited, what do you think's going on there?
Yeah, well, I think there's two things going on. One is right now, like the trend line is still that EV sales are growing as a portion of new electric car, or just as a portion of new car sales. So you've got this growth past 10% now into the 12% zone of all new sales. Looks like people are buying them. Then you get this survey that comes out and says, it's kind of dampened. People are getting less excited. So the second thing that's going on there are people getting less excited in general about high-priced cars. In the Auto Trader survey, it's being dressed up largely as, when put to Canadians about electric cars in particular, they'll come out with the general things that people are worried about: range, anxiety, price tag, and so on. But it seems like when Canadians show up to the dealer lot, we're still increasingly buying these cars. So what's going on here, I think, right now is, in general, if we pull back and take a look at car sales overall, in 2022 in Canada, car sales dipped pretty significantly. And then they went up in 2023. And most analysts said that's because people were sitting on cash during the pandemic, had wanted to buy cars, but the supply chain was jammed. So they finally got their cars and were able to buy them. 2024 is shaping up to be still strong in the SUV market, but high-priced cars are starting to struggle, and more Canadians are looking at buying hybrids, and hybrids are flying off the lots in a short period. So I think what we're seeing right now is people are starting to feel the pinch of inflation. They're starting to feel the pressure of their mortgage rates, and they're showing up to the lot wanting to buy cheaper cars. Hybrids fit that. If they're in an income bracket where they can still afford it, they are still buying electric cars more than we were previously. So It seems like there's a dampening, but that dampening in general is not EV specific, I would argue. It's overall higher priced cars and cars that cost more to operate.
Pointing to a study that was done by the University of British Columbia, they talked to people about their cars and what they would drive. And they found that the drivers there, if they were going to make a switch to an electric vehicle, would need to drive almost double the daily distance of an average motorist to break even. So I look at that study, and I think maybe that's also part of the conversation, that people are trying to determine how long it'll take to recoup the higher upfront cost of buying an EV. And perhaps some people are determining when they do those calculations that they just don't drive enough.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. I mean, our cars do sit idle for a long period of time, and the way that you pay it off is by driving it a lot. And if people are not driving those cars a lot, especially post-pandemic, they're not commuting nearly as much, the time to pay it off extends. So for those folks who are actually doing the calculation, it may look like the payoff period, especially for a higher priced electric vehicle, is going to take longer than they had expected. On the flip side, in those families and those networks where you do have a lot of kilometers driven, the payoff period is less than what that study would have demonstrated. The other thing to take into account within that study is there's a lot more models on the marketplace now available through leasing models. So if a family were looking at a leasing model and, you know, what they're paying right now in gasoline and diesel across Canada and the payoff, I would expect to see a lot more families paying off those vehicles in a shorter period of time with those lower price models. But, you know, the point holds, at the end of the day, not just electric cars, but cars in general are getting more expensive. And so your payoff is now starting to be a household calculation. Like, do you even need the car? You might need it, but you might not be able to afford it. And in this day and age, certainly with electric vehicles where they are, there's a lot of hope out there that the price point's going to drop. Well, there has been recent price point cuts by manufacturers to sell these things off the lot. But the reality is, battery prices are not going to radically be dropping in the next little while, such that we're going to see like these bargain basement prices, right? It is the case that especially if these batteries in these vehicles start coming from higher cost jurisdictions, including Canada, you know, where our labor rate is pretty expensive, so our battery costs are going to be pretty expensive for the people making them, it's very possible that these cars will get more expensive over time, not less. And so then that actually just leads to the household discussion of, do you buy a car at all? And that is the piece that I think the feds and all governments are going to really struggle with, is we're heading into a period here where we want people to convert. In reality, cars are getting more expensive overall. If they're electrified, they're getting even more expensive overall. You're relying on manufacturers to slash the price. The supply chain's not going to help that much. That means we really have to create a lot more mass mobility and public transit to pick up all the people that just won't be able to afford these cars, let alone electrified cars in the next 10-year period.
Yosipa, I've got access to a text board here, which you can imagine is quite entertaining during the course of a four-hour live radio show. And you should see the text board moving right now. I've got so many people that are writing in. I've got Tim in Stittsville who says the biggest problem would be the batteries. He's worried about the battery life. Another person, Judy in Elmount, is concerned about the end of life of the battery. What happens with disposable and end-of-life battery problems? Has that been solved yet? And then there's one person here, Jeff, who says the problem is the charging time for him. He said, how does it work where people are standing around for 30 minutes at a charging station? So he's pointing to the problem with convenience and the possibility of lineups if everybody gets an EV. What can you tell us about the charging time for some of these vehicles and whether or not that has improved through innovation?
Yeah, sure. I love your text board. So I'll go with the charging time first, and then I'll talk about the recycling piece too. On the charging time, your listener has pointed out a really important piece. It's not so much the charging time as it is the access to charging. Once you have an electric car, like I've had a Nissan Leaf and a Tesla, but I mostly take public transit. Nonetheless, when you are charging, you know, you got to bake that time in. And the big issue around charging that relates to adoption of electric vehicles in the future, that would be a game changer, is a lot of the automakers right now are dragging their feet on offering people charging as a service with the car purchase. So the only company that's really done this well has been Tesla, but that's a high-cost market. That's a high-income market. What has to happen in the next 10 years is you need those lower-cost cars from General Motors, from Stellantis, from Honda, from Ford, basically being sold to you with guaranteed charging access and guaranteed charging services. That means these automakers need to start building out those charging networks and stop relying on government and taxpayer to build out these charging networks. If you show up to the lot and you get a car for the price point you get it, plus guaranteed charging anywhere you go, that is a game changer for adoption. So your listener is pointing out a really good point that not only is it the access to the charging time, it's the fact that once you buy this electric car, you're kind of left on your own by the majority of car companies. And in reality, they really need to shift over to offering cars as a service with the charging as a service. And that has to land on their dime. And that's where the car companies are about 10 years old or 10 years behind. So that is delaying the adoption. On the flip side, for those folks who are worried about recycling and second life, what I can say is the light duty and the heavy duty market are two very different beasts. The good news is if you're thinking about electrification, like from that heavy duty side of coaches and transit buses, it's a great news story because public transit uses these vehicles like 90% of the day. They're workhorses, they're out and about, and there's a second life recycling integrated into those vehicles today. So it's less of a concern there on the heavy duty side where you do get these emission savings for the public taxpayer. On the personal car side, though, there's definitely a need for the growth of a recycling market. And right now, the automakers are getting away with not having to sell you a car that is guaranteed to be recycled.
And that's a problem. Legit. I mean, that defeats the purpose of getting one. You think about the millions of end-of-life batteries that we're going to have. Where do they go?
Well, that's absolutely a problem. And this is where, when we're looking at the public fleets, like those heavy-duty fleets, because municipalities buy buses, municipalities have declared climate emergencies in Canada, you're starting to see like municipalities and transit agencies saying, if we're going to buy 1,000 of your electric buses, you need to tell us where these batteries are going. There needs to be a recycling plan. And because the taxpayer is paying for it, we need that legitimate and open and transparent. So it's happening. In the auto world, that doesn't happen because you're selling to a personal individual and a household. And there's no power that one person has to demand a recycling program in their car. So what would have to happen and what would really be a game changer for a lot of purchasers of these cars is if there were government policy and regulation that said, look, when you show up to buy a car, the automaker has to sell you a car with charging access with a recycling guarantee. That would be a game changer for a lot of people. And it's entirely feasible to do. It's just that the auto sector has never been required to do it. Like, mind you, this is also a sector that up until 2 years ago, even last year, was still actively attempting in many cases to undo government policies in Canada and the United States that led to emission standards, that led to the creation of these cars to start with. So it's not like the auto sector is jumping forward saying, hey, we're going to create the best possible product out there with the best green credentials. It's actually a sector that's been dragging its feet and leaving it to household consumers to like raise the red flag of concern. If that auto sector and the auto sector in general were required to have that recycling program, like the certification that says where your food comes from, you want a certification of where your car battery goes, and you have the right to have access to charging that the auto sector pays for and builds on its own dime, that is a game changer for this industry. It's happening in the public sector market, those heavy-duty transit vehicles, but that's because the taxpayer owns the market there and has been able to push that. In Canada, the United States, we've really left car buyers on their own to have to negotiate this, and really the only way to do it is mass regulation.
Yosipa, it was a pleasure chatting with you. We'll definitely invite you back to the show. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Yosipa Paternik, who is the CEO of the Canadian Urban Transit Research and Innovation Consortium.
Thanks for listening to The Daily Review. Remember, the day in news happens here.
Every day as events happen, we're here for you. News Talk 580 CFRA.
Live, local, breaking news, weather, and traffic.
Or stream us anytime on the iHeartRadio app.